The premier event for infection prevention and control is coming to San Antonio this June. APIC annual conference brings you the latest research, innovative products, and practical knowledge to help you prevent infection. From inspiring keynotes to thought-provoking panel discussions, APIC 24 curates an extraordinary platform for knowledge exchange. Meet IPs from around the world who face the same daily challenges as you. If you work in infection prevention and control, you don't want to miss this event. Learn more and register to join us in person or virtually at annual.apic.org.
You're listening to the 5-Second Rule, brought to you by APIC, the Association for Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology. Together with our nearly 16,000 members, we strive to create a safer world through the prevention of infection. Join us while we talk to infection preventionists and other experts to learn the truth about some common myths related to the risk of infection and to get tips to keep yourself and the people around you safe from infection.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of APIC's The 5-Second Rule. And I'm super excited because we have a very heavy hitter in the world of infection prevention and control with us today. We have Sylvia Garcia Houchins of the Joint Commission. She is the Director of Infection Prevention and Control, Division of Healthcare Improvement. So welcome, Sylvia, and thanks for being on this episode.
Thank you so much for having me today.
So you really, I geek out often on the 5-Second Rule, but this is so exciting to have you here because aside from being the Director of Infection Prevention and Control, you are in fact a member of APIC and you've had oversight for infection prevention and control for a number of years. You've been in this for about 30 years. I don't want to date you or tell any secrets about your age, but you've been doing this a good long while across the different healthcare settings. And I know that you also have done quite a bit with APIC in terms of working on the APIC text. You've written and co-authored some chapters in cleaning and disinfection and sterilization. You have a background in microbiology. You've also done a lot of teaching. I understand one of the highlights that you shared is that you were able to do some training of healthcare professionals in Saudi Arabia. So you've done a lot. And I'm excited about what you're going to share with our listeners today. So I'll just get right into it. Sylvia, talk to us about accreditation in healthcare, big picture.
Big picture. So accreditation in healthcare is done by a variety of accrediting organizations, like the Joint Commission. And one of the big things is that people don't always know about accrediting organizations is that we're not regulatory. We're not regulators, and we're not part of the government. So we don't get to make the rules. We surveyed to the rules.
Okay, so let's take a step back because we have a lot of different listeners. I like what you said. You're not, and I think it is confusing for citizens to know this, but accrediting bodies like the Joint Commission are not regulatory bodies. They don't actually make the rules. And what did you say? You set the standards?
So we develop standards to improve upon what the regulatory requirements are. So any accrediting organization is going to have to follow any regulations, but it may also have additional standards to ensure that there is a minimum level of quality that's being addressed. So there's rules for different things. And sometimes there isn't a rule that says an organization, a health organization, has to do something. Let me give you an example. Standard precautions. Standard precautions is a core premise of infection prevention and control. But if you actually looked in the regulations, you wouldn't find something that says every healthcare organization has to follow standard precautions. That's where as an accrediting organization, we develop standards that say you have to follow standard precautions because this is a basic level that's expected in any healthcare organization.
So, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. Is it fair to say, look, I sound like a lawyer because I always, is it fair to say that in the absence of an official regulation, an accrediting organization can set a minimum standard?
Yeah, we add to those regulations. We add to conditions of participation. That's the other thing we do. As an accrediting organization, we may not only survey as an accreditor, we also may survey on behalf of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Okay, so before we get into that, and this is actually a good refresher for me. Talk to me like I'm in first grade, but it's also, I think, important to point out there's regulatory bodies that, you know, say you have to do this. Is healthcare facilities willingly sign up to be accredited? Isn't there a level of this is something that is done to tell the public, hey, we're a facility that wants to be surveyed. We want to make sure we're doing all the right things in terms of infection prevention and control and patient safety. So we want to be a part of this accrediting organization. Did I get that right? Absolutely correct.
Absolutely correct. So organizations get to choose their accrediting organization. And we are the largest and oldest accrediting organization for healthcare organizations in the United States. And so a lot of organizations want our gold seal. It says that that organization is meeting a minimum level of quality that other organizations who have not chosen to be accredited or have chosen another organization to accredit them may not be meeting.
Okay. So that, I think that's important for the public to know. When you walk into a healthcare facility, chances are they're going to be accredited by you, the Joint Commission, but there are others out there, and then there are other regulatory groups. But I think that's important for the public to know. It's like going to the restaurant knowing, you know, the health department is going to check to make sure the cook is, you know, washing his hands. And
are you a grade A or are you a grade C or are you a 90 or are you an 80? You look at those things when you go into restaurants, if they have to post it. Now, Joint Commission does require that organizations make the public aware of their accreditation status. So, you know, people are proud to show that, like I said, that goes gold seal. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important for the public to know not all organizations have to be accredited. Some of them get to choose. For example, we accredit ambulatory surgery centers and ambulatory clinics. But depending on what state you're in, you may be in a state that does not require accreditation. And so there may not be that extra measure of, I would call it a safety net for you to know that the quality is being assessed. And that happens quite a bit.
Okay, so I want to take a step back because that's interesting. First, let's set the stage. The Joint Commission, as you said, is among the oldest. It's not the only healthcare accrediting organization, but let's just focus on the Joint Commission for a minute. You've been around, I understand, for about 70 years. Is that correct?
We're on our 70th anniversary.
Okay. A little bit older than APIC. APIC is in its 50th this year. Yes. So we're middle-aged. So help me understand, Sylvia, and help our listeners understand. Obviously, you accredit across the continuum, right? So talk to us about the types of healthcare facilities the Joint Commission accredits.
So we accredit hospitals. That's a large chunk. Critical access hospitals. We accredit ambulatory surgery centers and ambulatory clinics. We accredit Veterans Association. We do home care and nursing care centers. I'm trying to go through all my list. We do special certifications for special types of care that's provided. We do, I'm trying to think, sorry. Wasn't quite ready for that one.
But it's essentially across the continuum, right? So
yeah,
from outpatient to outpatient ambulatory long-term care type settings all the way to acute care. And you were just pointing out, and I think that's interesting, that not all facilities must be accredited. So what does that mean? Do states, different states say you've got to have an accreditation? I thought it was voluntary.
So some states will instead of having a state survey, will accept an accrediting survey in lieu of it. Some may require both. And some require nothing.
Do you have some examples?
A doctor can open an office and say, I'm open.
Right. But you can be accredited. So, for example, there are other, and again, we're setting the stage for helping people understand what this means. Obviously, you're from the Joint Commission. There are others. So, for example, I know I've attended a few meetings at AAAHC, the Accreditation Association for Ambulatory Healthcare. My background was in rehab. There was CARF, right? DNV is another big one. These are different healthcare Correct. Accrediting organizations. But essentially that the concept is the same. You as a facility agree to be surveyed to make sure that you're meeting all the minimum requirements or exceeding them.
And that's what we hope. We hope organizations are exceeding them, not just meeting the minimum. But, you know, the issue is, are you going to be accredited if you aren't meeting those minimum standards? And the answer is no.
Got it.
You won't be accredited.
Got it. So you want to make sure if you're going to a healthcare facility, they're accredited. and I'm going to get into what that looks like and what that means in a minute. But so you oversee infection prevention and control at the Joint Commission. So talk to us about your job. I mean, what does that look like?
So my job, oh my goodness, what does it look like? So I came here in 2018 and it looked completely different than I thought it was going to be. So what does my job look like? So these survey teams go out to survey these organizations, and a large part of my job is to answer questions from the survey teams as they're out there. They run into situations where they look at something and they say, this doesn't seem right. This could be a threat to patients, or this could lead to harm down the road. I think I need to explore this more. They will call into our central office. They will ask to talk to one of the infection control subject matter experts. We have a person on call all the time. If that person is concerned, there's a lot more to this, we need to delve a little further, then they'll get me involved. And so then we go down the road of, tell me the scenario. Are we really looking at this appropriately, right? Are we looking at all of those parameters that we should be looking at to say this is a problem or not a problem? And we may tell the surveyor, you know what, you need to go back and get this information. You need to observe this situation. You need to interview some more staff. You need to look at some competency documents or something else. You need to pull some instructions for use to make sure that what we think you're seeing is really what you're seeing.
So it's kind of like, and again, I'm just, correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't want to oversimplify something, but the analogy for, I think, a lot of listeners who may not be working in healthcare is, you know, the health department's coming to the restaurant and they're going into the kitchen and they're making sure things are done appropriately. And if not, there's some consequence. Either they get cited or, God forbid, shut down because, you know, all kinds of crazy is happening in the kitchen. So what you're talking about is kind of like that, right?
We're going in and doing surveys, right? We're not doing inspections.
Okay.
We're doing surveys. We're looking at processes, really.
Okay.
Right. Good. We're not just looking at, is the temperature right on the refrigerator? Is the process there that is going to keep patients safe? You know, one of the key focus areas we've had since 2009 has been issues with disinfection and sterilization. Are the instruments that are being used in surgery or during procedures, are they being reprocessed in the safest possible manner? Is the process tight? So, because I could go there today and everything could look fine, right? Everything could look, all the temperatures could be right, all the dials could be right, but there's a problem with the process.
Right.
We want to make sure that it's going to happen.
I like what you said. It's a process. And let me ask you, do you think that's where what, I, you know, how you just corrected me and schooled me on that inspection framework versus process review framework? Is that something that you come up against when you're working with other infection preventionists and healthcare workers and healthcare teams?
Explain that a little bit more. What do you mean by we come up against?
Well, I mean, I just described it as an inspection, and you corrected me that you're really looking at the process, or you're in, saying, if you say you're going to do it this way, are you doing it this way? Is that an area that you think, or is that a source of confusion and misunderstanding about when the survey team comes in? Do you think that you're going in and people are treating it as an inspection when in fact it's really looking at process?
I think you just hit it on the head the nail on the head, right? Got it wrong. Nail on the head, right? A lot of people think we're there to look at a moment in time, and we've gotten bad press. People will accuse us of looking at their coffee cup on the counter, and we don't care about your coffee cup on the counter. What we really care about is your organization implementing process to keep you safe, right? Is there a possibility that because of something you are doing, you could be exposed to something infectious and therefore could develop a disease, right? One of the big things we look at, for example, is personal protective equipment. Not just are you wearing it, because we go around and we see someone in a room and they're not wearing a gown and gloves and mask to be appropriate for the type of isolation they're in. We want to know, how was that employee trained? Is there a training process? Are they competent? What did they base the decision on to actually what they need to wear? Did they do an appropriate hazard assessment to identify those situations when you as an employee could be exposed?
Yeah, I mean, our listeners are well familiar with some of our discussions around personal protective equipment, and as you say, some of the issues in regarding cleaning, disinfection, and sterilization issues. And I like what you said. It's not a moment in time. It's really to understand the processes, the training, and are they consistently implemented? Let me ask you, what does this look like? I mean, I just opened up a new hospital. I sign up to be part of you, the Joint Commission, or maybe one of the other big accreditors. What's involved? You come in, you do a survey to see whether we've set things up, right? And then is there a time frame or intervals that you go in and check these processes?
So when an organization first comes to the Joint Commission for Accreditation, they have to fill out an application. They have to give us all the vital statistics about themselves. What kind of services, treatment, what do they provide? What's their focus? And then from that, an initial survey is scheduled. They need to pass that initial survey to even get accreditation the first time. And then every 3 years thereafter, with a window, right? 18 months before, up to 18 months before, they're in the window. They could be surveyed early, anytime from 18 months to 3 years after we've been there. Now, if you did have a survey, and let's say there were some major issues. There were some issues that led the Joint Commission to say, everything wasn't quite the way we had hoped it would be. There are some organizations who are accredited, but need to have follow-up surveys. So it's not 3 years for everybody. If there were issues, you might be accredited with a follow-up survey. You might have to undergo follow-up surveys to say, yes, you not only put in things to fix the issue, but you've been able to maintain them. That's the part that most organizations actually don't experience, but it can happen.
Okay. So it's at least at regular intervals. And then if there is an issue, there might be more visits, more review to get that facility to meet the minimum standard requirement, correct?
To be fully accredited. back to full accreditation.
Thank you. Fully accredited. I need the language. And this is not atypical of any accrediting body. There's some, you know, there's a process where you apply, and then there's a process where you are routinely surveyed, and then, as you indicated, to be fully surveyed. Surveyed. So let me...
Fully accredited.
Fully accredited. Thank you. My gosh, I'm not getting the words right. You started to talk about your job and how that works, where, you know, you're brought in to help when there are questions from the surveyors. I mean, let's get into the meat of it. What would you say are some of the common myths about working with surveyors and addressing some of those concerns? And let's take that from what you hear from other infection preventionists and healthcare workers. What are some of the myths that you've come across in your time as head of infection prevention and control?
So that I'm trying to think of some myths. So just to go back a little bit.
Sure.
This is not the only thing I do as part of my job.
Oh.
So there's other things I do as part of my job that I think are important to your listeners. Other things that I do is listeners or infection preventionists, accrediting managers, any organization can also send in questions. So that's another thing I do, right? Is I want to do X. Is that okay? What are the rules about it? Could that be a problem? I have a situation. Would this be an appropriate approach to doing it? How would a surveyor see this? So I answer questions. I help revise standards. The Joint Commission is all about education. So we provide a lot of education, and I think that's something that a lot of organizations don't realize. If you go on our website, there are free resources open to anybody, free webinars, things that will help organizations do a better job maintaining safe processes. So I contribute to all of those.
And didn't want to minimize your work by any means.
So I just want to emphasize that survey is what we do, right? And I also didn't mention I'm also an ambulatory surveyor. So I'm a surveyor of record in the ambulatory program. So I also do that to keep my skills and know what it's like to be out there for the customer.
Absolutely. And I know that APIC has partnered with the Joint Commission on a few resources, and you are a frequent contributor at APIC annual conference. And I know that your sessions are always, you know, standing room only, or, you know, well, now there's so many virtual options. But so
let's be serious here. Why? Let's ask the why. Why are people in the room? Right? The people are in the room because they want to know what's going to happen during their survey.
Right.
They want to know what is it that the Joint Commission is expecting. And, you know, that's one of the interesting things. One of the biggest myths, I think, that is out there that you asked me about is that we're regulators. We don't make the rules. And our surveyors are a wonderful resource for organizations to learn from, because they go to so many different organizations and they get to see some of the best practices. And so when our surveyors are out there, they're looking for clues that there may be a problem with a process, right? So they see the nurse go into the room, do a blood glucose, come out, don't see the machine get wiped, and they see it go back on the holder. Okay, maybe there's a problem with the process here. They start to do what's called pulling the thread. Let's figure out, does that happen all the time? Are people not disinfecting that blood glucose machine? Because CDC has linked that to transmission of bloodborne pathogens, which could put patients at risk and also the organization at risk from a liability standpoint. So it's not about that individual nurse not cleaning the glucose meter.
So... Yeah, but, and I don't, you know, I hear you, but it's a pretty strong myth that's out there. I mean, we know, why is that? Where is the breakdown in moving away from thinking that you're either the regulatory, the quote unquote, you know, the police are coming, the, how can we, I say we, but it's really you. It's the royal we. How can we break that down? And you know, listen, there are also challenges, or there have been challenges over the years with maybe interpretation of a standard or a regulation that is not accurate and you know, or maybe a facility feels like they've been cited or quote dinged on a particular process or procedure. And can they, you know, what is the process? Can you have a conversation with the surveyor? Can you explain yourself? How does that work? And there's a lot but
this is great. There's a lot
can.
There. Right?
Do what you can with it.
Do what I can with it. So the first thing is, why do healthcare workers continue to see us as the police? Well, part of it is we have some organizations who try to use us as the police, right? So I have four kids who are nurses. So four children, four nurses. And, you know, they periodically will call me and say, hey, mom, how come I have to do this? It doesn't make sense. And I say, wait, we don't have a standard that says that. I don't know of any regulation that says you have to do that. It's not a condition of participation. I don't know. Go back and ask, because it's not our requirement. But they're like, they just did joint commission rounds getting ready for our survey, and they're telling us we have to do this. And they said, because the joint commission said so. Yeah, big problem, right? We have organizations who use us as the heavy.
Okay.
Right? And so staff are used to hearing that. Why do I need to do this? Because the joint commission says so. Well, guess what? That was one of the biggest myths when I came to the Joint Commission, is the Joint Commission doesn't say so. If an employee says, you know, if an employee says, oh, well, the Joint Commission says so, I'd go back and say, so tell me where you got that idea that the Joint Commission says so.
Okay.
Because most of our standards are not that hard and fast.
Okay.
Right? So I think that's an important part. I think, you know, we need to think about, you know, organizations have gotten this idea of some organizations have this idea that they're not allowed to talk back, right? They aren't allowed to ask for clarification. And that is absolutely untrue. Our surveyors are taught to be collaborative, to open for discussion, to have a morning briefing. Some organizations don't even allow other staff in the morning briefing. Some do, right? I actually was called by an infection preventionist. I was probably a year on this job, and she called and she said, I'm calling you because your surveyors are here on survey and they won't let me participate. And I was like, excuse me? That's not us. That's your organization. Your organization decides who gets to be in on the meetings, who gets to attend open, you know, sessions that are being planned. The Joint Commission does not. We are very inclusive. You know, we want to hear from employees, and they're supposed to let employees know we're there and that we're open to talk to them alone if they would like. I don't think that makes it out as much. So I think this idea that what the surveyor says is it, there's also an opportunity for a collaborative call, and I've done them. I've been in situations where the organization does not agree with what the surveyor is saying, and they can say to the surveyor, you know, this isn't feeling right. Could we please have a collaborative call with central office? The surveyor should then be calling in and saying, hey, they want a collaborative call. And we schedule one. We want to have the best assessment possible with correct information, with what's applicable to each organization. Because remember, everything changes by state around here. Right. Just like we've seen with the mask mandates. Right. Everything is different and we have to score accordingly.
Right. I think that's helpful to our listeners and to our infection preventionists across the country. And when someone says, because the Joint Commission or fill in the blank accreditor said so, challenge that and say, is that really the case? And you know, don't be afraid to have the conversation. I disagree, and here's why, and give a rationale. I think that's those are two really good pieces of advice. And again, I will just share, because we're here today talking with you, Sylvia, of the Joint Commission, but I can recall being at a AAAHC meeting and similar myths and concerns popped up. And I think it's just the general challenge of accrediting bodies and the healthcare facilities that they serve, that there's this sort of, oh my God, they're policing me this moment in time. I can't have the conversation. And to your point, you know, that's not always the case. That is not what you're there to do, is be punitive, but really there to help ensure that the processes are working to keep people safe. So I think that's a really, really good point.
And you just said something important. You said punitive, right? Mm-hmm. We try as an organization absolutely to not be punitive. You know, the greatest fear I ever had when I was an infection preventionist was, oh my gosh, they're calling central office. That's it. We're done, right? The surveyor would say, oh, I think I need to call central office about this to seek clarification. Are they looking at this properly? Are they not looking? Is there more information that they should be gathering? Help, I need a little direction here, right? But of all the things that I have learned at the Joint Commission, right, is if conversations get started about escalating something because of the degree of risk we are concerned about, one of the key things that we talk about is we do not want to be punitive. Everybody at the Joint Commission that I have dealt with is absolutely committed to quality. You know, you talk to my colleagues and ask them, why did they take this job? It's usually because something has happened in their life to say, we need this type of quality check.
Mm-hmm.
It's yeah. not about punitiveness or punishment. It is about ensuring the safest situation for anybody who's receiving care or providing care.
So, yeah, I think this is an important point for everyone to hear. It's not about being punitive. It is about quality and making sure ultimately that the people we serve, the patients and residents, are safe. Let me get to some of the alphabet soup. Obviously, you can't speak for government agencies, but you know, you mentioned earlier in the show that, you know, there are facilities that participate with Medicare and Medicaid, and that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, there are conditions of participation for hospitals, right? So if they're, you know, treating or getting payment for treating patients who are on Medicare or Medicaid, they have to follow some rules as well. And that is an example of a government regulatory group setting a rule, correct?
Correct. CMS has regulations. I think the important part here is they have regulations and then they have interpretive guidance.
Right. And you, as an accrediting body, part of your work, and again, I know you're going to correct me because I may get this wrong, but just so people understand, part of your role is to say, are you following that? Is that right?
Or does correct. So we have what's called deeming authority. Okay, so we are deemed by CMS to go into organizations and review to see that they are meeting the conditions of participation. If we are an organization's deeming authority, then we are surveying to the conditions of participation, or conditions for coverage if they are an outpatient facility, or conditions of participation, for example, for skilled nursing if we're doing that. But we are there on behalf of CMS, and we make a recommendation to CMS based on that, our findings.
Okay, great. And I think that's important. I'm going to throw up some more letters and funny acronyms now. So CDC guidance.
Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So I think one of the things that people don't realize is they are not a regulatory body. They don't make the rules. But some states have adopted CDC guidance or guidelines as regulation. or some other evidence-based guideline as regulation. So, for example, I live in Illinois, and in Illinois, ambulatory surgery centers and hospitals must follow the CDC guidelines for disinfection and sterilization. That's the minimum requirement. And then there's other CDC guidelines that you're required depending on which state. But basically, CDC, from our standpoint, is a group who provides evidence-based guidelines, which are the best practices based on scientific knowledge. And our hope is that organizations will take that into account as they develop their policies, their practices, their, you know, their procedures. But is it a requirement? Not always, unless someone else says so.
Right? Like the state.
Like the state or CMS. CMS has adopted some things, like CMS for nursing homes is very, for home care. CMS for home care is very clear that you must follow standard precautions. It's part of the conditions for participation or contingencies for coverage, right? I think it's important to realize that even though it's a best practice, the Joint Commission cannot make you follow certain things if they don't make sense for you. And it's not a one-size-fits-all. That's the other thing we see, you know, especially being a surveyor, in my surveyor hat, practice from one state to another can be very different. And when I look at practice from state to state, I'm looking to see, are they doing those things that are safe for patients based on the care that they are providing? And that's what our surveyors do. So one of the problems we often have is the IP who borrows a policy or a procedure from someone in another state. Does anybody on the listserv have a policy about, you know, how you do your laundry? And don't realize that the state they are in has regulation that says laundry must be done this way. The surveyor comes in and says, oh, we got a problem.
Yeah, you have to follow the state regulation, right? That reigns supreme.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it reigns supreme.
Just to confuse and muddy the waters a little bit. OSHA.
Mm-hmm.
Occupational
Safety and Health Administration.
Safety and Health Administration, which really is all workers, right? It's not just healthcare workers. That's a regulatory body, correct?
Correct. OSHA is a regulatory body. Now, again, with some differences by state, because states can choose to adopt federal OSHA, or they can choose to adopt their own. So, for example, Michigan has Michigan OSHA rather than federal OSHA. I think Oregon is another one where they have their own OSHA. You know, with the pandemic, Oregon OSHA came out with some pretty darn strict rules about how to protect employees from COVID in Oregon that were not even part of what federal OSHA was saying. So it really does depend. Now, OSHA, right? OSHA has regulations, just like anybody else. We look at those regulations. And so I think here's an important distinction. And I didn't really realize this well until I came to the Joint Commission. So we expect our organizations, our accredited organizations, to follow law and regulation, right? But we aren't OSHA inspectors. And if anybody out there has ever been through an OSHA inspection, I've been through three in my 30-year career, each lasting about a week each, coming into my organization for a particular issue and having things gone over with a fine-tooth comb, they focus on one little issue and spend a week exploring it. They have enforcement manuals just for that one little piece that they're looking at. We don't use the OSHA enforcement manual as part of our survey. But let's say we went into an organization, so OSHA has rules about personal protective equipment. I always like to use that one. I've been using it actually since fall of 2019. So even before the pandemic, right? OSHA has expectations. Organizations are going to do a hazard assessment. They're going to determine which jobs and types of jobs place risk. They're going to determine what PPE needs to be worn. They're going to train and educate and competency assess their employees, and they're going to enforce its use. What does that look like on survey? on survey, I go in and I see a cardiac procedure. The surgeon is wearing eye protection, his mask, his full gown, and the person who's assisting him is wearing a mask and is probably closer to the splatter point than the surgeon is. I, as a survey, start pulling the thread. Why is there a difference in what these employees are wearing? And I don't then go to an OSHA enforcement manual. Instead, I pull the thread and say, this is interesting. Can you tell me what's required to the employee? In some cases, I might get three different answers from three different employees. Oh, we got a problem here. Something's not clear in your process. Can you tell me what you require your employees? Well, at that point, they may say, we have something general that just, if you're going to be splattered, you need to wear eye protection. Well, that's not very clear, and that does not meet the OSHA requirements. So now we're going down that road of you're not meeting the requirements. A little different, right?
Yeah.
Than what OSHA would do.
Well, I think it's helpful, okay, Sylvia, to know, and I know you can't speak for OSHA or CMS or CDC or FDA, and yeah, there's a lot of letters. It's all alphabet soup, right? But I think it's important for our listeners who are not in healthcare to know that there are these both state, federal bodies, and then accrediting bodies that are all working to try to ensure that patients are safe, but also healthcare workers and all workers in these facilities. And while it's not always simple, it's certainly important and critical. And, you know, keeping up with all of it can be challenging, even for those of us, quote unquote, in the know. So I appreciate you sharing so much about the work that you do, the important work that you do, as well as some of the myths. I mean, is there one takeaway you want to share with your infection prevention colleagues in the APIC membership? Like, what would you love them to take away?
I would love them to take away that the Joint Commission is here to answer your questions as openly and honestly as we can. There is a process to do that. Anybody can ask a question of the Joint Commission. Just go to our website and ask the question. It's at the bottom of the jointcommission.org page. Ask a question of the Standards Interpretation Group, and you can have it answered. And there's no repercussion on survey. That's a myth. People think that if you ask us a question, your surveyor is going to find out, and they're going to be at your doorstep the next day to say, why are you doing X? And that is not going to happen. We want people to get better. We want to have safe care. It is all of our mission here at the Joint Commission to provide safe care and to help with that provision of safe care. And so we're here to answer questions and lead you, hopefully, down the path of figuring out the answer to your questions. So please ask.
All right. You heard that here, everyone. Please ask. Don't be afraid. You're not going to get in trouble. You're not going to be blacklisted. Sylvia Garcia-Houchins, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. And for more information about all things infection prevention and control, please go to www.apic.org.
Thanks for listening to The 5-Second Rule, produced by the Association for Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology Staff and the APIC Communications Committee, in partnership with Human Factor. Audio tech is Blake Alphen.